Mr. Van Emden, Reel 4, you're telling a story about how these officers went forward with a driver to reconnoitre the situation.
Yes, they went forward, and they had to dodge very quickly into a house. Fortunately, it was a Dutch house where they were sympathetic to the English, and they hid them upstairs in the room. The German tank stopped right outside the door, and the Germans were chatting and smoking cigarettes, and they went into the house and said, "Food, please, food."
Now, hang on, how do you know all this? Because you weren't there, were you?
I was told, no. I was told about it. I didn't see this firsthand.
Right.
That I did not see firsthand. The only time I saw it firsthand was when afterwards, after the war, I took my family back to show them round to all the different places, because I knew all about it.
So, what was happening to you?
What was happening to me? I was stuck behind the tanks because we couldn't move. And eventually, when the English who was at Arnhem retreated across the river to get back, 2,500 got back out of 10,000. 7,000 didn't get back. 7,500 didn't get back out of 10,000. 2,500 got back. Some of them were Polish, and the Polish general was very upset about the whole thing because he went into it and he got clobbered and he shouldn't have done. But as I said, I only heard this from the people who actually took part. I was on the outside, thank God. I was at Nijmegen looking, and we couldn't move. And when eventually, of course, they retreated, a good while after that they managed to take the bridge, and then we went forward again, and we went through to Belgium. I'm trying to work this out.
What do you remember about operations in Belgium?
We were supposed to go to Paris. We were on our way, about 15 miles from Paris, I think. There was no opposition at that stage. All we did was went forward, but we got sidetracked and we got turned off. And we couldn't make out why we got turned off. And we had to bypass Paris because Eisenhower, in his wisdom, decided to let the French, the free French who'd been in our country, in England, have the honour of taking Paris. By that time, the Germans had practically retreated from Paris. There wasn't many left. And General Leclerc came in with the Free French and took the rest to Paris. Meanwhile, that was about September. That was August, late August. And by about the 3rd of September, we went to Brussels.
Yeah, I think you've got your Arnhem stuff out of order, because that's Arnhem's after this, yeah.
Yes, it must be somewhere.
It's all right, I thought it was. It's not a problem. So what happened at Brussels?
So we went into Brussels unopposed. There wasn't a shot fired. And the Germans were running out the other end. And as we went into Brussels, the people were going mad. It's the first time I've seen about a million people. And they were all going mad with excitement. Some of the girls were climbing on the tanks to kiss the blokes. Other men came out with beer for us, and the general was going balmy because he wanted to go through quickly to try and get to the Germans. But short of giving the order, we'll run all the pedestrians down and kill them all before to get through, you couldn't do it. So we just got stuck there for a while, for a few hours. Finally, we got through. We went to the other side of Brussels, and we stopped there to regroup and get some supplies in. And while they were doing that, there's a little story about something that happened which I can still see now, as though it was yesterday. It was coming up to a Jewish holiday, a very sad festival called Yom Kippur, Yom Kippur, Yom Kippur. It's the fast. And three of us were in that vicinity, so we went to see a colonel in charge and said, could we have a day off and go to the synagogue to say the prayers and meet the people. So he said, I don't see why not. Gave us a jeep. There was a staff sergeant and another two of us. So we got back to this place, the synagogue. It was just opening. Now, it hadn't been open for 4 years. And for the first time, the people were allowed to go in there. It was open and they could pray. And we could see people, families, brothers, sisters, husbands, wives, children. They all got separated when the Germans came along in a hurry. They had to hide and people hid them and helped. But they didn't know if their closest family was alive. Husband got separated from his wife and so on. And when they got to the synagogue, they could see each other for the first time. You can imagine the scenes. Everyone went mad. And they treated us like, as though we're heroes. We won the war for them, which was ridiculous. But they carried on about it. And then eventually, somebody came over to us and very shyly said, I have a close relation in London. Is there any possibility you could just drop a line to say we're still alive and we're living at so-and-so? Well, that opened the floodgates. Everybody got in the act and wanted to do the same sort of thing. So we finished up with about 300 people. So we had a quick conflict. Said, well, we can't turn them down. What we'll do, we'll get the whole lot and we'll split them into three lots. And then we'll do like 100 yards, like 100 lines at school. You know, if you write the same thing every time. I met so-and-so and their address is so-and-so. They're alive and well. Please contact. And we did that, and we took it back to our unit, and we spent hours writing all these letters out and sending it off for these people. And I should imagine that some of the relations are still alive today who are in touch because of what we did. I don't know. But that was very good. Of course, eventually we went back to our unit at the end of the day and carried on.
Any other memories from that time? Any of the memories from that time in Belgium?
Any memories? Somebody lent me a soprano saxophone, which I learnt to play for a little while. Then I handed it back to them when we were going to leave. A place called Winterslag in Belgium. And it was right close to a German border. And eventually, it was now December 24th. And we were sort of having a lark amongst ourselves because there was our tanks, here with us, we were all absolutely stone cold sober. And we said, I wonder if we're going to get turkey and Christmas pudding tomorrow. That'll be a lark if we can do that. And nothing happened. And all of a sudden, it was dead quiet, all of a sudden, we heard all hell breaking loose. In some little distance away, a good distance away. It turned out it was about 20 miles away. It was the Ardennes. It was when the Germans attacked through the Ardennes with their tanks to get through to Antwerp to take the place back again, the harbour, because that's where they were getting their supplies through now. And they'd had to go all the way back to Normandy for their supplies again if the Germans succeeded in taking this Antwerp again. But they got about 100 yards from the actual water, and there was a petrol dump, which was what they were after. And they ran out of steam, they ran out of fuel, and they never did get it. Then the planes come over and put them out of action, so they never did take the...
And what was happening to you during that?
Very little. We were just waiting, and then the order came through to go, and they went into Aachen, which was the first town in Germany. A couple of days later, they went to Aachen. There wasn't a great deal of fighting when they got to Aachen, and I was with them. And there was a bit of fire, not a great deal of firing, because the Germans had to get out quick, and that was it. So we got to Aachen, and then we went through, we got as far as the River Elbe. We went through Cologne. That was in a right mess, Cologne.
Now, what was happening while you were advancing into Germany? Well, do you remember anything about that in particular?
My advancing into Germany.
Anything happened to you, or any new jobs or responsibilities?
No, I just carried on. I had the same job delivering petrol, and it wasn't bad because there wasn't a lot of opposition at that stage. Only one night back earlier than this in France, when we got to the tanks a bit late in the evening, decided to stay overnight. And so I took up a position next to a tank with my machine gun, and I heard a movement in the middle of the night somewhere in front of me. And I thought, I don't know who it is out there, but they shouldn't be there, so I opened fire. But I didn't kill anything. I think it must have been an animal, because I didn't see any dead Germans or the yells. I shifted the position of the gun quick, but nothing came back, and that was it. That all of that. We got to the River Elbe. That's what I think. And then there was a right carrying on there, because we got there and we could see the other side of the river, no problem at all to cross. And the Americans were next to us by this time, and the general said, we're not allowed to cross. And Montgomery came up, I think, as well as our general, Sir Alan Adair. They wasn't allowed to cross. Montgomery said, I have instructions from the Prime Minister, we've got to stop here. So we stopped there, and we hadn't been there for very long, about half an hour or whatever, and we saw thousands of Germans coming running towards us. They didn't want to fight. They had their hands in the air with their guns. Don't shoot, comrade, comrade. And they had boats that size. So we let them cross over. And when they crossed over, they were told to put their arms over in a stack, which they did immediately. And they said, as one of the soldiers, march them back to the rear and fix up something there where they can wait. And there were thousands of them. They all did, all come in. Not a shot fired, nothing. Eventually, they were scared stiff that the Russians would get hold of them. If they knew if they surrendered to us, they would live. And they did. They were quite happy to do that. There's no problem. And they just waited. And about a couple of hours later, we saw some more people arriving. This time they were the Russians. And we're supposed to meet the Russians there and shake hands and good comrades and all the rest of it, which we did, and they exchanged cigarettes and so on. And
you got on well with the Russians, then?
Oh, yeah, no problem. Especially the officers, because some of them could speak a bit of English. They were much smarter than the ordinary Russian soldiers. There wasn't much difference between the American soldiers and their officers, or the English boys and their officers, but there was a quite noticeable difference. They wasn't so clean, they wasn't particular, and they were sort of very villager sort of thing, whereas the officers were much better dressed and spoke better, and they came over, all shook hands and all the rest of it, and that was it. And then we were between Bremen and Hamburg, and that's when the war finished.
Now, what do you remember about that, the finish of the war? VE Day.
I can always remember VE Day. I was in Trafalgar Square.
Now, how'd you got there? I thought you were in Germany.
What happened was, at the end of the war, they decided that people could go on leave. And they could go on leave in strict rotation. So everybody's name, from the commanding officer down to the lowest driver, if you like, was put in the hat. And whoever came out first went first, and whoever came out last went last. And I came out last. I was the last one out, so I had to wait. And eventually, it got to my turn by about 6th or 7th of what was it, May. No, was it May? Yes.
VE Day was, yeah. Do you not mean, are you thinking of VJ Day?
No, VE Day. I was home for VJ Day as well, by coincidence. But it was a VE day, and I was in Trafalgar Square, and everyone went balmy.
So what do you remember of it? Tell us what it was like in Trafalgar Square that day.
Everybody in a very good mood, singing, cheering, dancing about, drinks going around, somewhere got cans of beer and distributing, and the main lot, of course, was at Buckingham Palace, which I didn't get to. And they had a wonderful afternoon. I felt very exhilarated. And that was it.
Did you play at all that night, one of your bands in London?
No, I don't think so. No, I was home with my family. I was home with my parents.
So you'd go back out to Germany?
Did I go back to Germany? Well, since the war.
No, I mean.
Yes, I went back. I had to go back to my unit, and that was and that went a bit wrong. I was stationed at near Nienburg, which wasn't that far from Hamburg, about 30 miles. And I had an arrangement with a commanding officer to go to Hamburg every weekend for a weekend to do some broadcasting with a band. And
tell us about the broadcasts.
Pardon?
Tell us about the broadcasts. How did you get onto that?
We went to see Hamburg, British Forces Network, the BBC. And they said, I heard the band said wonderful. So I was doing broadcasts from there on, say, Friday evening would be just an ordinary broadcast. Saturday would be a show where you accompanied the artists, the singers, and so on. Sunday morning was taken up with making a few records, short records, about 3 minutes ago, so they could put them on between a programme. If they wanted to fill a gap, they had a record they could put on. So I did all that.
And were you saxophoning or pianoing?
Saxophone. And this one particular Sunday morning, I said, I usually face one of the band. I said, I'll do one myself today. So I did something like Talk of a Town or something like that. And meanwhile, and then of course we came back to the unit for the rest of the week. And meanwhile, the commanding officer had to leave to go on a colonel's course. So while he was away, he put another officer in charge, and he didn't tell him about me going to Hamburg. And on about Tuesday night or Wednesday night, radio was on. I was in the barracks listening to it with him. Now, between this programme, we're going to put a record on. It features Henry Van Emden playing saxophone, and his solo is Talk of a Town. And the following morning, a very irritable officer sent for me in the officer's mess, and he tore me out a terrific strip. Who did I think I was? Was I in Kate Carney's army, going out to Hamburg and broadcasting when we should be here in the unit? And he's creating at me. Finally, he ran out of breath. He said, "Well," I said, "never heard of a recording." I said, "A dozen men in the unit can say, because I was there, phone up Hamburg and ask them if I was in the studio or was it a record, and there's your answer." Next thing I knew, he did me the biggest favour of my life. He had me posted away from my company. I was no longer a 704 company. He sent me to Berlin.
Who did you join there?
When I got to Berlin, there was another RASC, I think. And I was in the English sector, just off Sturmstrasse Street, off of Reichschanzlerplatz.
And this is 1945, still?
1940... Wait a minute. I've got to think this one out. I'll go back a bit. It was 1945, but the beginning of 90... But when the war finished, the general in charge of a division, Alan Adair, decided he's going to have a big party for some of his friends in other divisions and his senior officers. So he wanted the best band he could get to do the party for him, and I got the job. So I said to him, I went to see him. Yes, sir, what can I do for you? He said, well, I'm going to have a party. I want to play very quiet music as the people come in and I introduce themselves. And once that's done, we're going to have a meal. And when we sit down for a meal, play some show music, like Annie Get Your Gun, that sort of thing, Oklahoma, which was popular in those days. Do something like that and a bit of Latin American. A little bit louder, but you know, just so people can still talk if they want to. And then once the main course is served, you go and have your meal, because there's no speeches afterwards. Once we finish, at the end of the meal, all I'm going to say is I want everybody to have a wonderful time, enjoy yourself, and that's all. So it's up to you after that. So I want to make sure you had your meal before it starts. So that what happened. And then once it got to the dancers, you can a big party, as loud as you like. And the boys hadn't done a proper function for a year, naturally. So we did this function, and part of the band at that time was Benny Simpkins. And
that's Pete Simpkins, the old Imperial War Museum father.
Pete Simpkins' father. Pete Simpkins' father, Benny. Fabulous night. Everybody had a wonderful time, and from the sight of a general, depending how well I knew him, wonderful evening, sir, thank you all very much. Thanks, General, or thanks very much, Alan. And everybody gave them a booster to the hill. Wonderful, I never had anything like it. So afterwards, he said, come on, lads, you must have a drink with me, because you've done fabulously well tonight. I'm proud of you, wonderful. So we're chatting like I'm talking to you by this time. So I've got a six-piece band. So I said, you know what I'd like to do? I'd like to form a big band to compete with some of these American bands which had things all their own way for so long. All these Duke Ellingtons, Count Basie, Benny Goodman, all the rest of it. So I said, that's not a bad idea. Well, how many more do you want? I said, about a dozen. He said, a dozen? He said, we've just lost all our tanks, as you know. I said, yes. So all the regiments have got their names back again, the Colstones, Irish, Scots, Grenadiers, six of them. They've all got regimental bands, which are being reformed now. So surely, as about over 150, 160 musicians in that lot, you ought to be able to get a dozen people, what you want. And even if you can't, there's 20,000 men in my division, so you ought to do it. I said, look, if I go up to Colonel so-and-so and say, you've got a star musician in your Grenadier Guards band and I want him, what's he going to say to you? He said, oh no, you got it all wrong. You come and see me tomorrow morning and bring a slip of paper, and on it says, the Guards Armour Division is forming a dance band, and anybody who feels capable of playing in it can attend for an audition and report to Henry Van Emden, and you put down the place, the time and the day, and bring it in to me tomorrow morning. So, and I'll sign it. I said, thank you. So it was easy the first time to get to him, because he sent for me. This time it wasn't quite so easy. So a sergeant said, I'll take you to the adjutant. Thank you. Got there. He went red. You can't see the general. Who do you think you are? I said, I want to go and see the general. Tell him Henry's outside to see him. You never use first names in the army. Henry? I said, go and tell him. He said, fall in 2 minutes. I said, finish that sentence and you'll look the biggest fool ever. Now go and tell General Allen Adair, I'm outside. On your head. I said, don't worry about that, you go and tell him. So seconds later he came back. He said, he'll see you. I said, thank you very much. And of course I went there and made it worse. I said, morning General, how are you? He said, wonderful Henry. That was a wonderful night last night. You did so well. I said, thank you so much. I brought this for you. Well, that's right. Yeah, that's all right. Good. Signed, Alan Adair, General. He said to the adjutant, see, this goes right through part one orders, and everybody is entitled to have a go if they feel they're capable. When we got outside, he said, how did you do that? I said, you'll never know. And that was the end of that one. But it nearly come unstuck, because when I got to the morning of the audition, there was a quite big hall, and it was filled up with, it must have been at least 200 men ill. Oh, I've been here for ages, what have I done? And then Benny looked round, and his face lit up. He said, we won't be here long. Go and get this. And he told me what music to bring, which I just brought back from London. I'd just been to London to get some new music. And so he told me what to pick out. He said, when we go on the stand, I want you to take the secondary or third position. I'll take the fourth position. We'll leave all the main ones. He taught the trumpet player the same. We'll leave all the main places open and watch me. So he got on the stage. He called for silence. He said, everyone's going to get a fair chance, but I'd like to start off the proceedings with Ray. Will you come up and play lead alto, please? Wally, will you come up and play lead trumpet? Sam said, will you come and play lead trombone? He said, you can all get the other instruments out and you can all have a turn afterwards. So these people came up on the stand and they were so good, I couldn't believe it. They were fantastic. They played the music perfectly. They hadn't seen it before. And he said, anybody else? So of course after that, a few more came up, but they could really play. Anybody else who thought they were in a good thing didn't even bother, because they didn't want to make fools of themselves. And within about an hour, I got the band. I got a big band, five saxes, trumpets, trombones. The only thing I couldn't get hold of was a guitarist. So we had to be without a guitar for the time being. And then eventually some of the lads went to see a show, and it wasn't a very good show at all continentals. But one of them, before the interval, played the guitar, and it was absolutely incredible. So the boy said to him, we're rehearsing tomorrow morning, we'd like to come along and meet the band leader and meet the rest of the band and bring your guitar. So he did. And the band knocked him out completely. He couldn't believe what he was hearing. And we said, well, let's hear you. And he played something, he was equally good. It was fantastic. So somehow or another, I got hold of a general to arrange with his unit that he could join us in uniform, provided he didn't wear anything at all, no insignia, no signs, nothing, just a plain army uniform. And he could stay with us until such time as we disband. And he did.
Now, what was your band called?
The Guards Armoured Division Dance Orchestra.
And how often, did you play often?
Yeah, fairly. We used to go around to different places, different units in the whole of the area where we were in, to play for the troops. Sometimes we were away for 3 weeks, going to so many different places, then coming back to Bonn, which was our headquarters. And yeah, it worked out very well.
I thought you were at Nuremberg. Is this after you'd moved to Berlin or out?
No, for Nuremberg, well, I was outside Nuremberg, near Hamburg, and
this is before you left 704, though.
At that stage, I was still in 704, but when this captain got very upset because he'd been made to look like a bloody idiot, and I was posted to Berlin, then I was just in the RAC.
Before we do that, what about, can we talk a bit about Benny Simpkins? What was he like? We know his son. I mean,
Benny Simpkins was about my closest friend once we met up in the forces and he started playing with us. He was a tenor saxophone player, and if you are a good reader, you can become a full saxophone. But if you're a very good reader and you can busk, so you could play jazz and swing the thing along, you was on second saxophone. The first saxophone was the lead alto. The second saxophone was the lead tenor, who played principal harmonies. Then you had a third saxophone, alto, who played the thirds, and the fourth saxophone played the fourth. And that meant the just left the fifth saxophone, which is an octave lower than the lead alto on baritone.